Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Suzanne Ross of the Raven Foundation, and I'm very pleased to be hosting today's program on Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo at the Looking Glass Theater in Chicago. This is the Raven Foundation's fifth year of providing commentary and audience discussions for Looking Glass Productions, and we are pleased to be recording this pre-show lecture with Professor Andrew McKenna of Loyola University for WBEZ's Chicago Amplified. Chicago Amplified is an online upcoming events calendar and past events archive of arts and education events in Chicagoland like this one. So I'm pleased to welcome our future online listeners as well. At the Raven Foundation, we work for lasting peace by providing social commentary on politics, religion, and popular culture from the point of view of mimetic theory. Mimetic is the Greek word for imitation, and mimetic theory is a theory of human behavior rooted in the reality of our astounding ability to imitate one another's actions, emotions, and desires. At Raven, we like to say that the thing that differentiates us from our nearest relatives is not that monkeys imitate one another and we don't, but that we are much better at it. In other words, human beings are much more open to the influence of others than any other species. And that openness is responsible for the best and worst in us. So our social commentary at the Raven Foundation covers everything from love and creativity to rivalry and war. A sampling of our offerings is available in the postcard packets you have on your seats, and please pick one up, and we hope you'll visit our website sometime this week. And if you do, and visit our Voices of Peace section, which is our online radio show, you will find our most recent episode with our guest Heidi Stillman, the director of Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo. Bengal Tiger is an incredible play whose central character is a ghost, a talking tiger ghost, on a quest for meaning in the midst of war-torn Baghdad. The playwright Rajiv Joseph drew his inspiration from a news story that appeared 6 months after the invasion of Iraq in 2003. A soldier who was on duty guarding the animals at the war-damaged Baghdad Zoo shot and killed a tiger, an absurdity that prompted Joseph to explore the absurdities of war, or rather, our absurd lack of understanding of the impact of human violence on the human spirit. When human beings, the most supremely mimetic of all creatures, encounter violence, we cannot help but be influenced, even invaded by it, much like a virus invades our cells to make us sick. What you will witness on stage this afternoon is an artistic expression of the truth that for human beings, violence is a contagion that recognizes no distinction between justice or injustice, good or evil, perpetrator or victim. Dr. Andrew McKenna is an expert in mimetic theory and is a founding board member of the Raven Foundation. He will explore these ideas and more in his pre-show talk and also in the post-show discussion following the performance. He is a professor of French language and literature at Loyola University here in Chicago, and it is an honor to present him to you. Please welcome Dr. McKenna.
Thank you, Suzanne. There's a name that some of your program notes don't mention and that I may not get around to quoting, but I want to put it for you. Mimetic theory, of course, comes out of the writing and teachings of René Girard. And if it doesn't show up on all the paper or perhaps in my subsequent remarks, it's like that those letters on a map that you don't see because it names the whole territory. And the theory of mimetic desire is something that is an anthropology and a biblical exegesis and a literary criticism and a psychology and a sociology, and it stresses across many, many academic disciplines, including neuroscience and evolutionary biology. And I only mention that because the wonderful thing about the Raven Foundation is that it recognizes the importance and the explanatory power of this theory, and it has as its goal to get the theory out, get it out to a non-academic public. I'm an academic, and you know, we have a sheltered life, the tower, the Ivory Tower, and everything else like that. So I'm very grateful for this opportunity to talk about what I think are really important aspects of this play. Someone said to me, well, you don't want to give too much away. And actually, I won't. There's more given away in the interview with Rob Joseph than I'm going to talk about. And I'm going to talk more or less about what I think is the moral climate of the play and in its context, including a theatrical context, a theatrical tradition, a trajectory along which we can chart where this play emerges. Now, I don't want to read to you. I have a list of talking points, and I'm going to talk through them. And the first thing I want to do is just ask you to imagine something very easily to do with three overlapping circles, but they have to overlap each one. So at the center, you have something that they all have in common. I'm going to talk about three basic ideas, manifestations. I'm going to talk about incongruity. That's one circle. And I'm going to talk about the grotesque, and that's another circle. And I'm going to talk about the uncanny, and that's another circle. And obviously, these are various effects of what's at the center of this circle. The one place where all these overlapping notions and effects occur is at the center of those three circles, you want to put the word violence. That the uncanny effects, the grotesque effects, the incongruities of this play all spring from the violent, the violence that is at the volatile core of this play. I'll begin with the notion of incongruity. You know, you hear the title of the play, Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo. You know, it scans very eloquently, and it also jars, because you Bengal, Baghdad, what's going on here? For Americans, certainly, Baghdad means one thing, it means Iraq. The title, for all I know, might have been taken right off the headlines about that. A lot of us read about it. I remember reading about it in 2003, precisely because it was so freaky, so strange, so incongruous. And as resulting from this freak accident, where a man's hand is mauled by a tiger, the utter strangeness of it gives us pause about what it is that, what are we doing in Iraq? What's a Bengal tiger doing in Iraq? And if you had opportunity to read the interview with the author, which is in your, it's in the booklet for the theater, he calls it a ghost story. And so I'm not giving away anything when I talk about the fact that there is a lot of violence and people get killed and then they come back. And they come back and they're very chatty and garrulous. They don't come back in the Edgar Allan Poe mode at all. But what is a ghost? What is a ghost? A ghost is someone who returns from the dead among the living. But it's not somebody who died. It's someone who was slain. The ghost is always someone who's died at someone else's hand. And this ghost has some relationship to the living. And the mark the business of hands in this play. A man loses his hand to a tiger. We'll see another man slit his wrist and try to cut his hand off. There's a golden pistol, which is a firearm, but it's a handheld firearm. And it migrates, it circulates from hand to hand throughout the play. And it has, I think, the standing of a kind of fetish object or a kind of idol. Now, it takes no imagination for us Americans to realize that we have an idolatry of firearms. There are 300 million Americans, and guess how many firearms there are? You don't have to. We know that. We have an idolatry of violence. And I think that this play has a lot to tell us about violence. And I've been watching, and some of you have too, you've been watching the NewsHour, and they've had five nights in a row a series on gun violence. And there were two NOVA programs. And we go to the social sciences, and we go to the neurosciences, and how do we understand this violence, and how do we deal with it? They don't go to the artists. They don't go to the painters. They don't go to the playwrights. And that's my job. I teach literature. And I'm going to draw your attention to certain literary texts and to certain images. You all have a copy of this foldout. It's beautifully provided for us by Maura Junius. Some of the images, a lot of the detail is lost, but again, I pulled these down from the web. You can go online, look up and see them in all their glory, and see how much more detail, let's say, resonates with the action of the play that we will be watching. The author says it's kind of a ghost story, but we have to remind that ghosts are never come on their own. The ghost of Hamlet's father, the ghost in Macbeth, these are the returning dead, these are the returning slain. And so I could just as well call this a zoo story. Bengal tiger in the Baghdad Zoo. A zoo story. What do I mean by that? What is a zoo? It's a place where to view animals in cages, especially dangerous predators. That's why we need cages. And of course, these predators are not a danger to themselves. Tigers don't kill tigers. Lions don't kill lions. They're a danger to us. The one species on all the planet which is the greatest danger to itself is the human species. That's anthropology. That's biology. That's neuroscience. We are the species which is most dangerous to its own survival. Other animals have, there is aggression among other animals for mates and for food and all, but they have instinctual breaks to their violence. And so they have pecking orders and they have alpha males and everything else like that. We have no instinctual breaks to our mimetic behavior. And according to neuroscience, this mimetic behavior is right in our DNA. We have the most highly evolved mirror neurons. Other simians have them, but they're not as evolved as ours. We're missing that instinctual break to our violence. So we're the most dangerous species for ourselves. And it reminds me, there's a thumbnail definition that you get from Samuel Johnson on a very amusing essay called Vultures and Men. And Mama Vulture is trying to explain to Baby Vulture, what are these creatures called men? And she winds up the description saying that, well, listen, humans are the only animals that do not eat what they, do not devour what they kill. Now, that's a human specialty. Internecine violence, violence directed against members of our, lethal violence directed against members of our own species, only humans do that. And so the Mama Vulture says, humans are the animal that doesn't devour what it kills, and so it is a friend, a benefactor to vultures. See? And there's some of that snarky, there's a lot of that snarky humor going on in this play. The play has, it's about violence, it's not a tragedy. It's more about things like what we would call the grotesque than anything else. I like to think of it as a zoo story because it's about these uncaged predators that we humans are. And we are our own worst enemy. The murders and suicides that go on in our society and that go on in the play remind us of that. And that, therefore, we are strangers to ourselves. More strange to ourselves than we're willing to admit. Which brings me to the notion of the uncanny. Now, we have that term in our vocabulary because of Sigmund Freud. And he describes it as something which is strange and familiar, something which is ominous and ordinary, something which is both sinister and near, something which is about us and about something we can't identify with at all. That is to say, it is, for Freud, of course, it comes from the unconscious, but the fact is, that's what violence is. That's what violence is, human violence is. It's something we have all around us. We worry about it all the time, and we never see it in ourselves. We never see it in ourselves. We always see violence as something that we have to exercise, that is a logical necessity in reaction to the violence of someone else or someone's else, here or abroad. We can have defensive wars, and now we have wars of choice, but this, we didn't start it. Somebody else started it, or is going to start it, or meant to start it. My point is that the if you look at the image, very famous image, of Goya, Saturn, devouring. This is an image of the god Saturn devouring his own child. This is Saturn the god, but this is an image for Goya, because Goya doesn't believe in the Saturn. He doesn't believe in the Greek gods, neither do we. This is Goya's image of human violence, that we devour our own. As it just turns out, I have this book sitting on my coffee table at home, and Sandy Goodhart, who's staying with me, reminded me of that, and I said, yes, I know, but I already have a copy of this image. He said, Andrew, you don't understand. It also has an epigraph from Jorge Luis Borges. Now, this is a book. It's called The Future of the Economy, L'Avenir de l'Économie. And you've got Saturn devouring the children? Well, to put it very quickly, too quickly perhaps, it's a book about the fact that the market promotes values that its own appetites destroy. And markets have a tendency to destroy their own children. And we see that again and again, most poignantly and most recently, in 2008 and 9. And the quote from Borges is as follows, and it's kind of enigmatic, but you would think that the author had it in mind, and he most probably did not. But this is what Borges has to say about a tiger. I quote, this is at the end of an essay entitled A Brief History of Time. A Brief History of Time, which is an oxymoron. What? Excuse me, A Brief Refutation of Time. Once you use the word brief, you're in time, so you're both in time and out of time. I'll just read the lines. It's somewhat enigmatic, but it's also uncannily pertinent for this play. Listen to this. He says at the end, our destiny as contrasted with the hell of Swedenborg, European philosopher, and the hell of Tibetan mythology. He says, our destiny is not frightful by being unreal. It is frightful because it is irreversible and ironclad. Time is the substance I am made of. Time is a river which sweeps me along, but I am the river. So far, so good. It is a tiger which destroys me, and I am the tiger. It is a fire which consumes me, but I am the fire. You couldn't make that up. What I mean is, why a tiger? A tiger is a very beautiful, very attractive, and very dangerous animal. And we are all those things to ourselves. But what we don't want to acknowledge is the violence that our mimetic faculties enable for us. So if you look at the monsters in this foldout, the idea that we are monsters for ourselves, that I am the tiger. The idea particularly of the fact that we are strangers to ourselves, there's something uncanny about human, something both homely. The word uncanny is unheimlich. Heimlich is homely, and unheimlich is unhomely, foreign, alien. If you look at the illustrations number 7 in the medieval cathedral columns, the capitals, you have what Google lists among its images as grotesque. Of course, there's enough detail for you to see that these are monsters. These are, and what is a monster? A monster is something unnatural because it has, let's say, the torso of a woman and the body of a fish. It can have the head of a man and the body of a lion and the claws of an eagle. This is medieval iconography, and it is peopled with monsters. But medieval iconography also has a vision of the universe. And in that vision, you go to any cathedral main entrance, the portals of Notre Dame or Chartres or anywhere else, you see the Last Judgment. And you see Jesus sitting, weighing this in the scales, judging, and on the viewer's left, on his right, the tombs are being opened, people coming out of the tombs, and they're being escorted to heaven by angels with harps and lutes, and they're all looking up. And on his left, our viewer's right, you see the damned are getting out of their tombs, and they're downcast, and they're all chained together, and they're being led by, lugged around by these horny, scary devils into the gullet of a dragon, you see. So heaven is up there for the good people, and hell is down there for the bad people. It's very interesting in the late Middle Ages that these representations sort of disappear of monsters, real mythical monsters, dragons, griffins, sirens, etc. And what we get instead are grotesques. And here's a sample, but you can find them all over the place. Illustration number 8 is from the chapter house of York Minster Cathedral. And what you see is a classic Google move where the squares bring out the things you can blow up, you know. And there's enough evidence, if you just look a little carefully, you see, you're not looking at devils anymore. You're looking at human grotesques, where a guy is grabbing his mouth and his jaws, and he's sort of aping, as we call it, simulating some sort of monstrosity. That is to say, in the late Middle Ages, something happens in iconography, and monsters give way to something called the grotesque. This is art history. I'm not making this up. And it has a sense, I think, with the change in the way Christians think about their beliefs and the way they think about humanity, as if the idea of the monster has gravitated from something terrible out there to something strange and familiar and here among us. And the grotesque is something, in that sense, is precisely what violence is for us. It's something horrible, and it's something all too human. So that look at the Goya, the very famous Goya Saturn. I've already mentioned that. He's devouring his children. But let's look at the other Goya illustration, which is also very famous, from the Caprichos, which says, "The sleep of reason engenders monsters." And quite uncannily for us, in the lower right hand, you have a big cat, and it's a cat. It's a, not, you know, it's just, it's one of these dangerous feline predators. But for the most part, you have these owly, hawk-like things that are, you have these anthropomorphic birds, and these are the monsters. And what is that sleep of reason that Goya is alluding to? That is something that populates his engravings. It populates even more strongly the horrors of war. It's prophetic. It's prophetic because he did the Caprichos in 1799 before Napoleon occupied his country. And when Napoleon occupied his country, you had the first insurgency, guerrilla warfare. The guerrilla is the Spanish word, and it was the peasantry which rose against the military occupiers. And everybody was at their absolute worst behavior. The French National Army became this army of torturers, mutilators, etc., and the peasants became this population of mutilators and torturers to the Napoleonic army. I'm talking about the fact that art has a prophetic capability for us if we pay enough attention to what's going on in our culture. Now, these monsters, the sleep of reason begets them, but these monsters are us. It's what we don't see in ourselves. We don't want to see it. We see it as a logical necessity, a response to another's violence. And in a sense, we're right. Well, the violence isn't in us. It isn't even an it. Violence is a relation. Now, where do you go to understand human relations? Where do you find the first thoroughgoing exploration of human relations? Before Freud, before social sciences, you go to the theater. You go to the theater, you go to Greek theater. Greek theater is a long and critical reflection on their own myths, but it's about human interaction. Sometimes a god here and there comes in, comes out. I'm going to talk about one Greek play, which I think this play has very strong resonance with. In any case, This clearly is a play in which violence spins out of control. To quote René Girard on this topic, at the end of his book on Clausewitz called Battling to the End, it's more than once, he uses this expression. He says, violence is never lost on violence. I'll give you the French, it's my job. La violence n'est jamais perdue pour la violence. It means that violence is never wasted in violence. Violence always gets something from violence. Violence never completely expends itself, even though that's what we want violence for. That's why we want firearms, and that's why we want and need a constabulary and an army. But what do you know? The army is broken. It got broken in Iraq. What happened? We went in there, and I don't mean to be this a critical view of foreign policy. This play is not about foreign policy. However, it is what happens to foreign policy when it has violence at its spearhead. Let me give you, everybody knows about Iraq. It was a complete cultural meltdown. Political, cultural, religious, and military. It is a classic case of what you see in this devastating painting, which again, this size, with all goodwill and efforts on Maurer's, doesn't give you a sense of all the detail, but you get enough here, and you can go online to find more. This is illustration number one, Bruegel, Dulle Grieter. Now, Bruegel, precisely, is a late medieval, early Renaissance painter. Painter in the time when the grotesque is coming out on easel painting. You have Bruegel, you have Bosch, and you have all these grotesque statuary in the medieval cathedral. The one from York Minster is precisely the 14th and early 15th century. If you just look at this illustration, you see what? This is not a vision of hell. People get it wrong. This hell is a vision where the bad guys get tortured and the good guys, you know, get to music. You got the rock and roll and the sex and drugs are in different places, if you will. This is a vision of hell on earth. This is a vision of Iraq. This is a vision of Napoleonic Spain, which begat the very notion of a popular peasant insurgency that was first labeled in the early 19th century as guerrilla warfare. You see Dulle Grieter, Mad Meg, Greta Margaret, okay? And she is walking through this space. And you look, and what you have an admixture, a grotesque assembly of animal and plant forms, animal and human forms. Look at the left. You have something that looks like a castle, but it has eyes and a gullet, and people are inside of it. Look all over. Look to the upper right. You have fire. You have some sort of incendiary activity or explosion. I won't go into the detail. You can go online and inspect that. And this is a late medieval vision, not of hell, but of the hell that humans make for one another, of hell on earth. And I'll give you one quotation among very many one could use. We all know about Iraq. This is our historical and political experience. This is a quotation that I am indebted to Bob Kaler for on his weekly column. This is about war. I forgot, Bob, the name of the column, but just Google Bob Kaler and you'll get a steady feed of his editorials. He's a peace journalist to whom I owe a great deal in terms of textual references and insights, not only to violence, but also to writing. This is a quote from an Iraq vet. And I'll just quote from the whole thing. Tyler Boudreaux, by the way, yeah, this is a quote from a column of Bob's about something is called moral injury. We go out there and kill people, and so that is fatal injury. But what is the moral injury to the people who do the killing? We're going to see plenty of that in this play. Tyler Boudreaux, one of the vets quoted in this book called Soul Repair, puts it this way, and I quote Bob quoting Tyler, "They say war is hell, but I say it's the foyer to hell. I say coming home is hell, and hell ain't got no coordinates. Hell is no place at all. So when you're there, you're nowhere. You're lost. If you hired a painter to paint that quote, you would get Del Greet, Mad Meg, going through buildings and gardens and trees and forests, and but all this stuff is grotesquely changed and transformed and metamorphosed. We see this in the play. We have plant and animal forms that are mixed. We have a talking tiger. Everybody knows about that because it's in the program notes. We have all these people who come back from the dead. And they don't come back again like these Edgar Poe characters. They come back in a very chatty, offhand, garrulous way. One guy comes back speaking in Arabic. He says, "Where did you learn Arabic?" He says, "Oh, I learned it in death." It's a great line, one of my favorites. But my point is that the uncanny and the incongruous and the grotesque are words for violence in this play. And it's important because the uncanny carries this idea of nearness and foreignness and how we are foreigners to ourselves. This is not a play about foreign policy, except to the extent that it is, Iraq is the site of this cultural meltdown that you see in Bruegel's painting. Meltdown, literally. And that it dramatizes a crisis of difference. Now, a crisis of difference, which is wrought by violence, which is unloosed by our incursion into Iraq, and I quote the former Secretary of Defense. He said, "Well, you know, stuff happens." He was supposed to say shit happens, but he can't say that, you know, on live TV, and I don't know if radio can carry it. We'll hear some obscene language, lots of it, in this play, and I'm going to have something to say about the artistic use of that. But in a moment, but I want to stay with this idea that this is a play is about the crisis of difference that violence unleashes, and that it is a crisis, therefore, of identity. We don't know when violence is spreading around in this maelstrom. We don't know whom to help and whom to hate. We don't know friend, and we don't know enemy. We don't know who we are because we do things we don't plan to do and we don't see ourselves doing, and we'll hear from more than one character in this play saying, "That's not who I am." So are we who we are, or are we who what we do? It's about a crisis of difference. And the crisis of difference is always a crisis of meaning. And there are two ways in which this crisis of meaning is brought forward very powerfully, and you'll experience them. One of them is the fact that a central character, but really central, is a translator. What is translation? It's taking the meaning from one language to another language. And when you have a crisis of meaning, you don't have language, you just have mindless repetition, which is exactly what anybody's foreign language sounds to us if we don't speak it. It's just noise. And you have a crisis of meaning that is very successfully dramatized in the play in that way. You have a crisis of identity, but it's foregrounded by a number of things like the topiary, where you have animal forms, you have plants which are virtually twisted into animal forms. You have the question of whose side are you on, who are the good guys, who are the bad guys. This question is always raised, and it's being raised in our own press today. But I think this play goes to the heart of the problem of violence. It's not about politics. It's not an issue play. It's interesting that religion has no formal role. There's something about a prayer for the muezzin, etc. But it has no formal place in this play. But we have to deal with some very nasty customers whom we might call, you know, diabolic or demonic or satanic. But I think the role of religion is played by the vulgarity, the violent language. Now, the place of religion in all cultures has been to contain violence. And in traditional cultures, archaic cultures, in all the cultures of antiquity, the way to contain violence is that you get it to streamline on a single victim. And all the violence of the community is expended, exhausted on that victim. And people can be friendly because they are united. They are, in fact, in harmony of all against one, of unanimity minus one. And sacrifice has been the way for traditional cultures to control their violence, to contain it, and contain it in the sense of keeping it back, but also having it around for when you need it. When a crisis emerges, find the person to blame it on. fine. And that person, we, in modern culture, we call that person the scapegoat because we know that person, he or she, is not responsible for all this violence circulating in the community. But it's a good idea to believe that. And if you do believe that, you will have harmony. Everybody will be hacking away at the same corpse. Well, we don't believe in that anymore. We've expelled sacrifice from our culture along with monsters. But we obviously, as a result, have a problem with violence because we have no sacrificial channel through which to expel it. It's all over the place. And the United States is the poster boy, if you will, for the omnipresence of violence among all generations and in all institutions. When we talk to our European friends, they simply can't believe this thing we have with firearms. In violence, in Greek tragedy, you never saw it unseen. It was always reported. They felt that to have violent action on the stage would be dangerous. It would be bad models. It would contaminate the public. They would be afraid that if the people identify in the audience with what's going on stage, they'll identify with the violence as well. And by the way, there's now neuroscientific evidence of that kind. Okay, we've heard about it, a report from Ohio, another from Stanford, that these video games do incite aggression. I'm not saying that every spectator, every action, every participant in a video game is going to go out and take people out, but we don't know. The jury's still out on that. But what we do know is that for the Greeks, banned violent action from the stage. And so did the French in their neoclassical period. Shakespeare brought it in, and they thought, what is going on here? For as far as Shakespeare, for the French was concerned, Shakespeare was just grotesque. And they couldn't believe anybody would admire that until the 19th century that gave us Goya, among other things. Well, okay. Rounding off, the Greeks banned action, violent action from the scene, obscene. That's the origin of our word, the obscene. And what we have in this play is a lot of obscene, foul language. And if it's carelessly used, you know, you watch Gangster Field, and the F word is all over the place, and that's done for a kind of realism. But if it's wisely used the way a Jonathan Swift or a Rabelais can use it, or a Voltaire can use it, it is host to a certain meaning. Violent language, obscene language, it is the idiom of outrage, of anger. It symbolizes a crisis of meaning. If everything is simply fucked, and if that is, there's a line that says, this is crazy as fuck. And by the way, that's not even grammatical. You see, so grammar is a meltdown, and communication is a meltdown with all this F word and all this S-H-I-T. And so I think the strong language, if you want to call it, occupies the place of religion in the sense that it represents violence where religion has no sacrificial canopy to economize it. It reminds me of two plays. A famous play in France called Hugues le Roi. And you have two pictures of it, number 2 and 3. And it's very interesting. The second one, the first one is drawn from the original program in 1896. And they revised the image of King Ubu in World War II and decided to pin it on Kaiser Wilhelm. But the play itself is about, it's an orgy of destruction. It's about power without principle. The first word in the play is merde. It's a neologism. It's the word meld, which means shit, and he makes it into a verb. And this king has all the power, so he kills everybody. He kills the army. He kills the army. He kills the nobles. He kills the middle class, the financiers, etc. And he famously said that we will not have finished the work of demolition until we demolish the ruins. You know, it's a prophetic play. When Yeats saw it in 1896, there was a riot in the theater. Of course, it begins first word in the play is an obscenity. When Yeats saw it, he walked away and he said, after us, the savage god. Anyway, because he saw something prophetic about it. That is to say, Ubu, king, this mega destroyer, demolisher, 20th century is littered with potentates, dictators, tyrants, totalitarian leaders of that kind. I don't need to list them. There was something prophetic that Yeats saw, that way back in Greece, the great tragedians also saw. And of course, I'm talking about Euripides and the Bacchae. In the Bacchae, if you look at illustrations, I believe it's, well, it could be 4 and 6. Let's go to Bacchae. Yes, excuse me, thanks, 9 or 10. You have illustrations on a Greek vase, very elegantly drawn, and in a Roman sarcophagus of the savage god. Yeats said, after us, the savage god. The savage god par excellence is Dionysius. He's the god of revelry and of violent revelry. His main disciple is Bacchus, the god of wine, and people drink, and they have sex, and they get into fights. And these, how do these fights end? In the Bacchae of Euripides, they end when the revelers are out there in the woods, and the king Pentheus wants to put an end to this disorder. And he's persuaded by Dionysius to watch this disorder going on, of men dressed as women, women dressed as animals, and everything else like that. And they see him sitting in the tree, and they bring him down, and they tear him to pieces, literally. And that's what you have in illustration 9. You have women tearing the king to pieces. One of those women is Pentheus's own mother. And of course, you see off to the right, you see this satyr-like character on his knees, and you don't know whether he is worshiping or in a state of thrall of any kind. But you have the outcome of an orgy of desire, which becomes an orgy of violence, which results in the destruction, dismemberment of a king. And this gives birth to the cult of Dionysius. Don't mess with Dionysius. You don't believe in Dionysius, you're going to be torn to pieces by his revelers. Now, there are many other Greek myths, but the playwrights give it order and a sense to that. And to finish my remarks, I think I have to walk you through let's look at this other illustration of Dionysius from the sarcophagus. It's really uncanny. You have a lion, and on the lion's back is Pentheus, the king, because he's going to be torn apart because the wild crowd will mistake him for a lion, because a wild crowd, a cloud in violent effervescence, always mistakes. It tears anybody apart. It doesn't care. Its violence, it has no direction. And somebody says, kill the beast, that person, man or woman, child, becomes the beast. And around that, you have the satyrs with their horns, the revelers. You have men and women with musical instruments, vine leaves in their hair. What's going on in this play is the kind of thing that has a deep theatrical background. We find it in Euripides. We find it in Alfred Jarry. If I had time, we could show you how we find it in Bertolt Brecht as well. But I'll just end with a quote from a book called A Woman in Berlin. And it's written by a woman in post-war Berlin, occupied by the Russians, and there's murder and rape, and there's no control over it anywhere. And this is what she says. She says, rumor, the goddess Fama. I always pictured it as an old woman all shrouded up and murmuring away. Gossip. We feed on it. Now remember, we're in Berlin. All the communication systems have broken down. All commercial operations have broken down. All social relations are up for grabs. She goes on to say, and this is a woman who's caught in the middle to it. It was a victim of multi rapes and managed to survive to write this. In the old days, and she means in antiquity, people got all their news through hearsay and word of mouth, you know, before the net and TVs and cell phones. It's impossible, she says, to overestimate how this affected ancient cultures. You see, because we get bad news, we go on our BlackBerry to see if it's true and things like that. We have all these connections to inform one another. But imagine a culture in which only rumor, you know, no newspapers, radio, TV, etc. It's impossible to overestimate how this affected ancient cultures, how unclear and uncertain their view of the world must have been. Spooky, nightmarish, a swamp of murmured horrors and fears, of malicious men and resentful gods. This is a play about all that. But there are no gods. There are only malicious men and resentful men. And malicious men. The gods are gone, and all the wrath is wreaked on humans by other humans, and we have to try to make sense out of that. And the characters did a lot of speculation about God's plan for all this, but we have to remember, these questions don't arise from the ear of an 18th century philosopher. They arise from the volatile core of the play, which is violence. And the meaning of the play, these people are talking about the meaning of life, but the meaning of life is not finding the answer to the question of the meaning of life. The meaning of life is how to get along with one another, how to keep ourselves from killing one another. And we haven't learned that. And it's not obvious that we're going to learn it, you know, from our social sciences or our brain sciences. We have a lot to learn from our dramatists and from our painters, and I thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Andrew. We have a few minutes for questions, if anybody has questions or comments for Professor McKenna.
Yes, hi.
Yes.
Hi, I really, really enjoyed your talk.
Thank you.
So I was having a rant on the way over here, and I thought it was relevant in a way, because I was thinking about how we as humans also deal with the environment and how we actually are completely destroying our own environment, and thinking about just, well, the inspiration for that was the astronauts looking at the Earth from outer space.
Yes.
And that we don't really get that we're all one and that we all are in this together. And until we get that, where are we?
Right. And the prospects are not very bright because people say it's bad business to worry about the environment. And there are factions, et cetera. And my only, let's say, quick response to that would take another look at Bruegel's painting. That environment is unbreathable. And that's the planet we're heading towards. And we have to, if we're going to recognize a common world and a common humanity, we have to learn to recognize the violence which is unique to us as well. There are two things that are unique to humans, two things only. Language and non-instinctual mimetic behavior, by the way, and our abilities to deal with each other are always clouded by the shortcuts. Blame it on somebody, find the person who brings the plague to the city, and by the way, if we get that person, maybe the plague won't go away, but at least the plague of violence, and by the way, in Greek theater, the plague is always a plague of human violence. So you're absolutely right. The environment is something that we ourselves have destroyed. Lions, tigers, and bears don't destroy their own environment. Vultures are benefactors of our environment because they clean away sources of infection, etc. They're going to have a... So, yes.
And interestingly, this year's conference on mimetic theory is focusing on the environment.
Mm-hmm.
It's in Iowa in the summer. Colloquium on Violence and Religion, anyone. It's open to anyone who would like to go. Are there any other comments? Yes, Bob. And this is Bob Kohler, not Bob Kaler, by the way.
Sorry. Hi. Andrew, really, really, really well done. A couple of times you said the play is not about foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you're right, but I'm like, why not? Why isn't it about foreign policy? And if not, why not?
Good question. It's not an issue of play. It is about this foreign policy disaster. And obviously the author has seen something much bigger than that, because he's blown it out into big questions about the meaning of life and what is God's, you know, plan for certain species, etc. And so it makes us, think about that. And I think it's successful in not limiting it to, you know, because when I say it's not about foreign policy, it's not a political play. It's a play about, to me, it has anthropological dimensions and dramaturgical dimensions, drama being about human interaction, which are much bigger. And it's very easy to fasten on foreign policy and say, so, well, we won't do that again. But by the way, we keep doing it, you see. I mean, before there was Iraq, there was Vietnam. We destroyed the culture. Mass mayhem, murder, all kinds of genocide went on, etc. The problem can't be solved by the State Department or the Pentagon. That's my point. The problem is much deeper and much wider. It's something that we all have a hand in. And by the way, this play about hands is a play about hands, you know? And everybody has a hand in this violence. Everyone, including all of us sitting here. If only because we pay taxes. At least, you know, 51% of us or something. Yes?
Oh, hold on just a second.
You just made a distinction about, you said something was non-instinctual.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if what we're learning about human behavior and how we respond to each other and their environment is making, that's not a valid distinction anymore. There was something just this weekend, I can't remember specifically, but it's in New York Times, some study that showed how people were reacting to things in the room and things that are around them without having any awareness that they were doing that. And that behavior was being modified by smells and, you know, that I think that maybe we attribute too much to culture and to society or to choice than is valid, that we aren't more instinctual animals than we acknowledge.
Animals don't make moral choices, we do. I agree with you, we attribute much too much to choice. That's my point. That's Jean-Pierre Dupuis's point about the market. The market is all about rational choice actors, right? Pardon my French, that's bullshit. They're acting, they're speculating, they're imitating one another, and you get these speculative bubbles and they burst and it all falls down and then they start all over again. I agree with you 100% about the choices, but the reason I want to pull away from instinct is let's not blame it on animals. Animals have never and will never destroy their own habitat. This is a human thing. So I think it's important to distinguish between ethology, which is animal behavior, and anthropology, which is human behavior, and which is out of control.
When animals are in a disturbed environment, they do that. I mean, anybody that's raised hamsters know that if they keep breeding and there's too many in the cage, they start to eat their young.
Fine, but that's an artificial environment.
Yeah.
No, but in their own habitat, they wouldn't do that. They might, they might eat their babies, but they control their own environment. They control it. They don't destroy it. That's a human specialty, I think.
Any other questions? The only thing I did want to come back to, Andrew, is the very important point you make that there's no religion in this play, mm-hmm. even though there's a lot of God talk.
Mm-hmm.
And it's reminding me that in our discussion with Heidi Stillman, the director, I asked her about the other play she directed, The Brothers Karamazov, in which there is a lot of religion in the play, and it happens to end on a very hopeful note. And this play has no, I'm not sure. Let me say, for me, it didn't end in a hopeful way. But we can talk about that after the play with everybody. But I'm wondering if you could talk about that religion in the way you've been discussing it as this attempt to control violence, which has broken down, but also perhaps as a source of hope. Is that a possibility as well?
Yes, in this sense that we are in the sleep of reason. Reason is mostly asleep among us because, as René Girard is making it perfectly clear, that if we think the same things, we will agree. 2 and 2 is 4 every single time. 1 and 1 is 2. But if we desire the same thing and it cannot be shared, there will be violence. And so it's counterintuitive. But if we desire the thing, there will be violence. And we need controls over that because we don't have an archaic or traditional culture in which all that violence is expended on some sort of scapegoat surrogate victim. So we are more responsible for our violence than ever. We know more about it. Which is good news and bad news, because there's more and more violence. and more sense that it's our problem. We can't blame it on the gods or on the animals, you know. And we are in a we're in this kind of apocalyptic situation, which is Dalgrita, which is Bruegel's prophecy of the way this world is going as it de-Christianizes. And on the other hand, we have to be hopeful. The Brothers Karamazov is a very hopeful novel. But the other novel he wrote just for it, called Demons or the Possessed, you know, which is, and Dostoevsky doesn't believe in devils. He believes that we're in our effort to be gods for one another, you see. We've lost belief in the gods, and so we should all try to be gods for one another. We're going to wreak havoc. And in that play, you have a total cultural meltdown. Mm-hmm. So you have the apocalyptic in Dostoevsky, and at the end of Karamazov, you have what they call the eschatological. You have the hope and the destruction. Yeah. And we're still at that crossroads. Yeah.
I would argue the point that violence among humans is increasing from traditional societies, and you know, for the last 2,000-3,000 years, 4,000-6,000, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. I would actually, there's quite a bit of argument that it is actually declining among human beings, not increasing. Doesn't mean that the violence that we have is not horrific, but looking at traditional societies, they were in constant warfare with other societies. Mm-hmm. When they first anthropologists went to New Guinea, Papua New Guinea, they found that all of those old traditional societies were at constant war. Mm-hmm. And that when you look at Native societies, pre-European, there was constant warfare. You look at Mayan civilization, there was constant warfare and constant fighting.
Yes.
So
mm-hmm.
I think it actually is a characteristic of human beings that violence is present, and it's not sacrificial.
It's not sacrificial.
Correct. So that I would argue that violence is actually, you can say, per capita is actually declining, not increasing.
Yes and no. Yes, true. Example, the Aztecs made war simply in order to capture victims for sacrifice. That was just the purpose, and it's actually the purpose of a lot of these archaic or primitive societies. They made war all the time. And I just read something in the New York Times recently. There's one tribe, and the anthropologist is saying, well, why are you making war? And why can't you get along with these people? And why are you fighting? And the guy, finally, his his native informer said, listen, it's about women, 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 women. It's not about sex, it's about reproducing themselves. The difference is, among other things, that these societies were made war to keep the violence out of the community. You knew whom to hate and whom to help. You hate the Sunnis and you help the Shiites and vice versa. That could be the Nambiquara and the Boro. Name your tribe, okay? That violence was also an economy of violence which threw it out to its external borders. Today we live in a world and there are no borders. All borders are porous. And violence can erupt anywhere, number one. Number two, we have means of violence. We have nuclear weapons, you see. So you can say, well, violence is on the run, but the whole show could be over, you know, in a few seconds, you know. So I acknowledge that argument. I'm familiar with Steve Pinker's article, and I think that he's left the ranch and he's in an area that he hasn't really studied very well. I happen to think that violence is, we know more about it, and we have less and less control all the time. And certainly at the level of nuclear arms, you know, it's out of our control. With Iraq, with Iran and with North Korea, you know, and we can go back into history where, you know, when the Cuban crisis, Castro said, go on, do it, use the bombs, you know, let's start a war with America. Mao said the same idea. Mao said, listen, I could lose 30 million people and still raise an army. So he wants Stalin to bring in the atomic weapons against us in Korea. I'm not persuaded of that idea that we're able to control or that we have less of it.
Say that.
Yeah. No, you didn't. You're right. Yeah.
You did not say that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
We have time for one more question for Gary, and then.
I'll take it as uncanny.
Wait. Put it on.
Yeah.
Uncanny. I'll take uncanny. Plays like we're going to see.
Mm-hmm.
Violent video games.
Mm-hmm.
Post Second World War Japanese slasher cinema.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this constant barrage of violence as entertainment and educational vehicles, with a footnote of "Isn't this horrid?"
Mm-hmm.
is what is feeding the reduction of actual violence? Now, that's making two statements, and I said it was bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
But we're looking for a solution, mm-hmm. and we search religion for the solution. We search higher meanings for solution.
Mm-hmm.
Is the groveling that we're doing with this horrible man's inhumanity demand that is smeared across, that you can't avoid?
You mean in the media?
Is that actually stopping violence?
Well, it's incongruous because, in a sense, what does it do? It hardens us. It inures us to violence. It accustoms us to violence. And you know, the stuff on the video games is that this is brain science. That people who really get into it, they track the neurons, and they're firing away, and there's more aggressiveness. Now that chills down again. But what about the cases in which it doesn't? You know, and for instance, what happens? What the? Well, again, I'm not a neuroscientist, but the my medical friends tell me about the post-traumatic stress disorder, where you see the amygdala, which is the emotional reaction to the prefrontal cortex, to tell the amygdala, you know, that okay, this is not a threat. That circuit is worn out, it's broken, etc. So these men are wired, etc. I agree with you, Gary. That's an issue. The representation of violence. Does that encourage violence or discourage it? There's not a causal relationship. The evidence seems to be there certainly is a relation, not a causality. But the fact that our media are absolutely drowning in this violent spectacle, most of which is sacrificial because there are bad guys out there and the good guys always win, you know. I don't think it's good for our soul. I don't think it's good for us to believe that we can kill the beast, and that the beast is not us, and that there's nothing beastly about us. There is nothing beastly about us, because the beasts are not like us, you see. The beasts don't pollute their environment, and they don't eat one another, destroy one another. I think we have a real problem about violence in the media that we can't address because of humans' skewed understanding of violence. We obviously, it's good box office. It's terrific box office, so no mess. But is that just a sacrificial scenario? You know, the voice of the people is the voice of the gods. I don't think it's good for one's moral conscience, you know, to, you know, cheer on these destroyer types and everything else like that. And, you know, it's even Clint Eastwood, who rose to power. He could take out a whole band of, you know, guerrilleros and things like that. And now we have Clint Eastwood dying, you know, like he's on the cross. But it's still a paean. But the film, the industry is still driven to this idolatry, you know. And by the way, the film industry is the American film industry. That's where all the money is. That's where, and the French have started making films like we do, etc. And I don't see where it can lead to anything good.
Yeah. I'm going to have to bring it to a close because we have to go see the show. But. The violence in the show will definitely trouble your conscience. I think I can say that safely. So stay afterwards. Some actors are going to come out and talk with us, and Andrew will be there, and we'll continue the conversation. Thanks, you, Andrew.
Thank you.